On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ken Jennings knows trivia. He's the winningest champion in the history of TV's game show Jeopardy. 2 years at the mast of geography, European capitals, the Daily Double. 75 games before he stumbled $2.5 million in winnings. He's been called the Michael Jordan of trivia, the Seabiscuit of geekdom. Now, Ken Jennings is turning around to look at trivia itself, why it captivates, how it lures us in from Who Wants to Be a Millionaire to Trivial Pursuit at the kitchen table. It is the most democratic pastime, he says. And by the way, what marsupial has fingerprints indistinguishable from humans? Up next on Point, Ken Jennings and the siren song of trivia. Joining me now from Seattle is Ken Jennings. He won a record 74 games on Jeopardy, lost his 75th, and walked away with more than $2.5 million. He's author of a new book, Brainiac, Adventures in the Curious, Competitive, Compulsive World of Trivia Buffs. Ken Jennings, thanks for joining us. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So what kind of guy are you who's the most winning contestant in all of Jeopardy history? Have you been a trivia buff from the get-go?
I have. You know, in Brainiac, I sort of described the traditional nerdy childhood of the trivia buff, you know, just filling notebooks with oddments of facts and just obsessed with information of all kinds, seemingly from birth, no matter what the source, you know, the kind of kid who will sit staring as the movie credits roll just because, hey, it's something to read. And every trivia person I talked to for the book described, oddly, virtually the same childhood to me. There must be some trivia gene for this that gets turned on in some of us that makes us information sponges.
Ken, I was fascinated by the fact that in addition to maybe just being a natural-born information sponge, you spent much of your childhood abroad, much of it in South Korea, watching Armed Forces television, their U.S. Armed Forces television, watching Jeopardy. Was it a kind of lifeline back to the home country you didn't live in?
That's exactly right. You know, living overseas, you feel so isolated, and my friends and I would just clutch to any scrap of American pop culture we could. You know, if somebody had a new VHS tape of a music video, everybody passed it around just because you clutch to it like a lifeline. And Jeopardy was one of those lifelines. It was on every day right after school on the only TV channel we could watch. And so, you know, you had a classroom full of fifth graders all, you know, pretty much obsessed with the minutiae of last night's Jeopardy game, just because that was what was on after school.
You write that it's harder getting onto Jeopardy than it is to get into Harvard. Describe for us how that initially happened with you. How old were you? What were you doing? And how did you get on the game?
I had, you know, my whole life, since I was 10 years old, I had, you know, that was pretty much my only career ambition, was to be a game show contestant. And guidance counselors never understood this well, but but for some reason, 20 years went by before I actually said, okay, well, you know, might as well actually do this. I had started to see people I know on game shows. I had played Quiz Bowl and similar games in college, so it was often people that I knew that I would see winning millions of dollars on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and paying off their student loans.
That should be me, said Ken Jennings.
Exactly. That settles it. These are not just anonymous people anymore. This is something that you can actually aspire to. So a friend of mine and I drove down to L.A. just to try out for the show, which they tell you not to because, as you mentioned, there are astronomical odds.
30,000 who'd like to do it, 400 spots typically in a year. Getting into Harvard is about 8 times easier, you say.
That's exactly right. But we bucked the odds, and we actually both passed the test, luckily enough. There's a very hard 50-question written test that you take, and that pretty much empties the room. And then because apparently the ability to answer very hard trivia questions doesn't really select for America's most dynamic, telegenic people. There's also a little personality, a portion of the program. And then they pretty much say, yeah, don't call us, we'll call you. And you expect to never hear from them again.
We're going to come back and look at that Jeopardy career. 75 games long, 74 winners, one loser at the very end of a very, very long stretch there. But turn around with us, Ken, and look at this bigger world of trivia that you're writing about in your new book, Brainiac. What makes trivia so compelling?
Part of it, and you know, this is sort of unfortunate, is the competitive thrill of it. You know, the joy of actually having something in your head pay off, and even better, to beat the other guy with it. And often this is where trivia people get sort of the tag as the insufferable know-it-alls. You know, it's not just enough to know something; they want to know more than you. But I think there's more to it than that. I think there is just joy in knowledge about the world around you. You feel informed. You're able to make connections with the things you see every day. It's easier to learn new things. So it is just a whole different way of seeing the world, in addition, you know, to being a stick you can bash your fellow nerds with.
You write about it being the most democratizing game because everybody can sit down and play. I guess the evidence is there all over. I mean, millions and millions of copies of Trivial Pursuit have been sold, and you remind us of these waves of popularity of trivia, the $64,000 question in its ilk back in the 50s, and then right on through, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? I mean, even Jeopardy's comeback, an example of that. It seems never to go away, or at least to come in waves.
Yeah, this isn't like the Pet Rock or the Chia Pet. You know, trivia is not just a kitschy fad. It seems to come back every decade or two, and that goes all the way back to the 1920s. There was a very successful series of trivia bestsellers in the late 20s, where readers could pit their skills against public intellectuals of the time. You could see if you could beat Dorothy Parker or Robert Benchley at a trivia quiz. Mm-hmm. So this is just something that it keeps coming back. You know, it must say something about us as a people that. You know, trivia is in a sense our national pastime.
What's the sort of first awareness that you read about in your research of trivia? When do people start talking about trivia as a spectrum of factoids?
Trivia as a name, you know, trivia as a name for a question and answer game didn't exist until the late 60s, which is sort of funny. You know, the words just entered the language, but it's really only 40 years old. But the roots of it go back a lot further than that. I was most surprised to see that one of the very first newspapers in the English language was a London coffeehouse weekly called the Athenian Mercury in the late 17th century. Mm. And it was edited by none other than Jonathan Swift of Gulliver's Travels fame, among other people. And this newspaper's whole raison d'etre was to answer reader questions about pretty much anything. And a lot of these questions were like indistinguishable from a modern syndicated trivia column. People were asking the editors, you know, about bodily functions or weird animal facts or weird pop science stuff. So, yeah, trivia, apparently, the roots of it go back 400 years.
And was it considered, worthy, or was this considered fluff? Can you tell how people looked on it at that time? Were they aware, as you are, that it's got some kind of catch for the human mind it's hard to turn away from?
They took it very seriously. You know, many other questions in this weekly were, you know, deadly serious questions about matters of scriptural interpretation or, you know, advice column for lonely hearts. So people were taking these questions of, I guess they called it natural science at the time, you know, equally as important as a scriptural minutiae. But today we would just call this stuff trivia.
There it is, trivia. Ken Jennings is with us, the all-time winningest champ on Jeopardy. Ken, begin to take us into that forest of questions that you managed to answer there. Give us some examples that'll give us a sense of the spectrum of knowledge that a trivia champ has to have, at least in that venue.
Yeah, Jeopardy is not for the specialist. It's for the player who knows a little bit about virtually everything. And because of that, it's very hard to cram for. You know, it's not like your 8th grade bio quiz. You could show up on Jeopardy and have to answer questions about opera, the Crimean War, hip-hop, and, Hollywood Westerns of the 1930s, you know, in rapid succession. And, and if you're someone who knows everything about the NHL but not much about anything else, you can wait a long time for your category to come up.
Hard to cram for, but you did cram for it. How'd you do that?
Well, as I found out watching the show, I confess in Brainiac to when I was cramming for Jeopardy, to watching the show 2 or 3 times a day, and not just sitting on my couch, you know, spitting out potato chips at the screen as I yelled answers at Alex Trebek, but actually, you know, taking it much more seriously, standing behind my recliner as if it were a podium, jamming my thumb up and down on one of my kids' Fisher-Price toys as if it were a buzzer. And I noticed that the same categories, the same kinds of knowledge kept coming up time and again. Jeopardy always asks you about your presidents, your U.S. capitals, or your world capitals, your Shakespeare. I felt I had to study up on potent potables because I'm a Mormon, I'm a teetotaler, but I needed to know how to mix all these cocktails.
That always comes up on Jeopardy.
Comes up. You know, how do you mix a Brandy Alexander? How do you mix a Gimlet? So my wife and I made flashcards and studied these things for pretty much 3 weeks straight. We were talking about nothing but, fruity cocktails and James K. Polk.
Let's hear just a little bit of that. Ken Jennings on Jeopardy.
Ken.
Who is Rutherford B. Hayes?
That is correct.
Ken. What is Nolo Contendere?
Ken.
What is Footloose?
Ken.
What is Ankara?
Ken.
What's the Citadel?
Ken.
What's the Library of Congress?
That's it.
And it goes and goes and goes with Alex Trebek. Now, the funny thing was here, they pre-tape all these shows. So for many months, you knew you'd been on there with the longest streak in history, but nobody else did except for your wife and I guess your boss. How did you keep that secret?
It nearly drove me crazy. You know, you start to see why Spider-Man is so messed up keeping that secret identity secret. The Jeopardy tapes it shows 4 months in advance, so I had won almost 50 shows and $2 million before any of them even aired. And
wow.
You're contractually bound not to tell anyone your million-dollar secret. And so I was flying back to California a couple times a month secretly while my boss covered for me at work. If my parents called my cell phone, I had to pretend I was at work instead of driving down the San Diego freeway or whatever. It was a double life. And in Brainiac, I say that I literally felt like Clark Kent, you know, at his boring office job, unable to tell anybody why he keeps, you know, flying out the break room window for to lead a glamorous double life.
So you're a smart guy. Did you end up feeling, you know, glorious because of these victories? Or was it like, oh, Jeopardy trivia, how trivial can you get?
I got to say, I don't know if my wife is listening, so I don't know if I should say that it comes behind our wedding day and the birth of our son. But winning that first game on Jeopardy was as happy as I have ever felt, I think. It's just something I had dreamed about since I was 10 years old, you know, being on a game show. To actually win, you know, to have this, you know, the apotheosis of your 10-year-old dreams. It was just an amazing, amazing feeling. So I would be the last person in the world to put down trivia. And I don't really like the word trivia, you know. It suggests that knowing things about the world is trivial. You know, we might as well call it general knowledge or cultural literacy. That's what it is.
It wasn't all serious trivia on Jeopardy. Here's a moment of humor with Ken Jennings.
Less than a minute now.
Tool time for 200.
This term for a long-handled gardening tool can also mean an immoral pleasure seeker. Ken.
What's a hoe?
No. Whoa. 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 They teach you that in school in Utah, huh? Al.
What's a rake?
A rake is right.
What's a hoe? No, a rake, and you a good Mormon. What was up with that, Ken?
It was one of those things where, as I was about to say it, I thought, there is no way this is going to be what is a hoe, but it's only a $200 question. It'll get a laugh.
Wow.
I paid $200 for that laugh, but I think it was worth it.
We want to begin to get some answers here. We put some questions out. Let's see. The marsupial with fingerprints indistinguishable from human is, Ken Jennings, for nothing?
That's a koala bear. If you're going to do a crime, you should try to frame it on a koala.
What is it that makes a good trivia question? Not any little detail makes a good one, you say. So what makes a good one?
Right. Many people have the idea that, you know, trivia is easy. There's no art to it at all. Alex Trebek's probably just making that stuff up on the fly. But no, a good trivia question takes a lot of work. It can't just be a random fact from the Britannica. This has to be something, the trivia is sort of the cool or sexy tip of the knowledge iceberg. This is the stuff you want to remember. Even if you get the question wrong, you're happy you heard it. It could come up in handy. It could come in handy later at a party or, you know, it's the anecdote you want to share with people.
We've got callers who want to stump the champ. Let's turn to them. Watertown, New York. Terry is on the line. Hi, Terry. You're on the air with Ken Jennings.
Hi, how are you?
We're great. What have you got?
I wondered if your gentleman knew who invented the modern sewing machine, or as we term it, the bobbin system that is currently used.
Okay, there's one.
Boy, nothing's more exciting on the radio than different kinds of sewing machine, huh? Elias Howe, maybe, or Singer? I'm not sure which.
Oh, very good. I'm surprised you knew that. It was Elias Howe, who was my great-great-grandfather, who was not a good businessman, and therefore I am not a wealthy man.
but you've got a great piece of personal trivia. Terry, let me ask you, in your household, are trivia games popular to play them, to watch them, or is this beyond you?
I am not a trivia fan, but I have a brother-in-law who is remarkably... He will sit and watch you. Ken, he watched you on Jeopardy. He watches it every day, and he'll fire those answers off on every question, which absolutely blows me away.
Does he whoop Ken Jennings? Is he faster than the master?
I wouldn't go that far. But what he doesn't have that Ken has, I ask him, why don't you go on that show? And he says, because I would get nervous and choke.
Nervous and choke because of the time factor?
I believe so. Or just some. I think there's a lot of pressure there. I think that the remarkable part of what Ken was able to do, or any of those people that are on that show, is not just knowing the information, but the speed at which you can access. Your processing speed is remarkable.
Terry, thanks very much for your call, and good on you for Grandpa Elias and the sewing machine. Ken, you write about this speed factor. First, just knowing when to hit the buzzer. I mean, talk about trivia. We're down in fine detail here, but knowing when to throw that hand out and bang on the thing, never mind thinking of the answer, is a big piece of this.
Oh, yeah, it's a game in its own. Most of the players on the show know most of the answers. They've all passed the same very tough audition. So typically the winner is just the person who has mastered the timing on his button. You got to wait for Alex to finish reading the question and wait a beat and then jam on that button as if your life depended on it. And it's a matter of, finding that, being just a few milliseconds ahead of the person next to you without being too early, or they will lock you out.
And what about knowing the answer? Do you have to have it just like a knee-jerk instinct, kind of just a reaction to know it? Or are you thinking it through? Was it that music that makes us crazy goes up and down?
Often you can read the clue before Alex does, so you do have a little extra time to think about it. I did start to get to know a very odd feeling of not having the answer at the tip of my tongue, but some part of me, like my thumb, knew that my brain would know it. So, I'm frantically buzzing and then trying to dig it out in the few seconds you get. So there's this odd feeling of not knowing the answer, but knowing that somewhere you might know it.
All right, listeners, we've got questions for you. What pasta name, very common, means little turnips in Italian? What is the northernmost world capital? And who was the only actress to win an Oscar for portraying another Oscar winner? Jesse's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Jesse, you're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
How you doing, Ken?
Hey, Jesse.
My question for you was, now, not having your brain power, I'm not sure if you may have even actually answered this question already on TV, but I don't think so. Do you know what the first man-made object that moved faster than the speed of sound is?
The first man-made object? I'm not really sure. Is it some kind of like...
to break the sound barrier.
Some kind of projectile, some kind of missile of some kind? I don't know.
Not exactly a projectile, I wouldn't say, but you're on the right path there.
I don't think I've ever heard this. I think I'm giving up.
Jesse, you've stumped the champ. What have you got?
I'm stumping Ken on National Public Radio.
what's the answer?
The answer is, to my best understanding,
yes,
is the tip of a bullwhip.
And therefore the crack.
Of course. Yeah, I guess that's why you hear the crack.
Wow.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's how it works.
That's terrific. Jesse, thanks very much for your call. Let's get another from Santee, South Carolina. Bill, you're on the air.
How are you?
We're good. What do you know, Bill?
Who invented the peace symbol, and what does it stand for?
This is the circle with the kind of a steering wheel in the middle.
That's right.
I think it's supposed to look like ND, like nuclear disarmament. Is that right?
That's correct.
That's the story I heard. I don't know the name of the creator. Is it your great-great-great-grandpa, like the sewing machine guy?
Well, I wish it was, but it was actually Bertrand Russell, the mathematician and philosopher.
Interesting.
That's great. And Bill, do you ask that with a point, with an edge?
No, I have no point.
just for the sake of it. Just for the sake of a piece.
That
symbol.
Is sort of the beauty of trivia. Sometimes it's knowledge for its own sake. You don't need to. You don't need any didactic point. It's cool to know that Bertrand Russell invented the piece.
It was actually a lot of fun watching people at Grateful Dead concerts, and I mean they couldn't answer their own names half the time, but
right, but they could hold up a peace symbol, and good on them for doing it. Bill, thanks for calling. Ken, you made a kind of a journey across the country in search of the truest trivia buffs as part of your research for the book, Brainiac. One of the places you stopped was in Wisconsin, Stevens Point. Tell us, we're going to hear from there in just a moment, but tell us about what goes on there, why it drew you.
I had never heard of this, but Stevens Point bills itself as having the world's largest trivia contest. And after having seen it, I would agree. It's a small college town of possibly 25,000 people. And every year, fully half that number, about 12,000 people, take part in this 54-hour radio trivia marathon. They stay up all weekend and answer trivia questions one every 8 minutes on the local radio station. And there's a parade, and these people sort of plan their whole years and, in a sense, their lives around this event. Some of these teams will take notes on every sitcom or TV advertisement they see. They'll keep every candy wrapper and cereal box they buy just in case something there comes up on next year's trivia contest. It is a lifestyle, not a hobby.
And for 54 hours, Stevens Point, Wisconsin becomes, as you describe it, the trivia capital of the world. At the center of that event is a man called the Oz, who kind of runs things, who bellows into his megaphone, "Are you ready to trivia?" His name is Jim Oliva. He joins us right now from Stevens Point. Jim, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Hey, Ken. Long time no talk.
Hey, Jim. Nice to talk to you again.
Jim, it's great to have you. Now, describe, what is the role of the Oz in the trivia capital of the world for those 54 hours?
Well, to kind of antagonize and add some glue to the mix, I guess.
Do you come up with the questions, Jim?
I write them with one other gentleman.
And who are these 12,000 people who tend to play each year? Surely it's not just half the populations of Stephen Point.
Oh, no. A good 40% of the players come in from out of town.
Wow, that's amazing. What's your sense of what the magnetism of trivia is? Is this just something that's part of the town's civic life and therefore just local tradition, or is there something bigger going on in Stevens Point that you're capitalizing on?
Well, I think that a lot of it has to do with the fact that we've suffered through a long, hard winter, and it
happens every April, so the ice is breaking.
The ice is gone, and also I feel that there's the camaraderie with these people. They've been playing most of their lives. Some teams have been playing 25 or 30 years, and they have started playing it themselves. Their children grew up playing it, and now their grandchildren are playing it.
As one thing that Ken Jennings points to is that Google has arrived on the scene, and the whole Internet, since you began doing this, since kind of the predecessors even at Lawrence University there in Appleton and Beloit College, now you've got Google. If everybody can sit home with Google and listen to the radio and answer the questions, excuse me, Oz, but how does that work?
Bring them on.
What do you mean? Google's not enough to bring in the
not
answers?
Not enough. Now, Ken will verify that Google's not enough. You have to take notes. The note-taking is very, very important, and even just your knowledge, because there are things that you see or you remember that just aren't on Google. You cannot Google everything.
Ken Jennings, fair, true, or can Google make a trivia master out of anyone?
If you need to Google-proof your trivia, there are trade-offs involved. You do end up making the questions, more and more esoteric. They relate more to details. And, to a city of 12,000 people taking notes on every sitcom they watch, this is perfect. I mean, this doesn't have much in common with the kind of trivia you and I play around our coffee tables and our game boards. But they certainly have a good time, and the fun is certainly contagious.
Ken Jennings, Jim Oliva, The Oz. Stand by. We've got Eric calling from Orangeburg, South Carolina. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Eric. What do you know?
I enjoyed your hometown this weekend.
Well, is that right? Well, is that a trivia question?
No. I just wanted to ask him, I don't have a trivia question, but I was going to ask him, do you remember a show from the late 70s named Tic-Tac-Doe?
I do. I was a huge Tic-Tac-Doe fan, and I remember watching when Tom McKee won his 40-odd games in a row in the early 80s.
Ken,
do you remember when Brian Donovan in the late 70s won a bunch of shows in a row?
I do. You're actually talking to someone who does remember individual Tic-Tac-Toe champions. I am sort of sorry to say. I do remember.
Eric, thanks for your call. What was Tic-Tac-Toe? Is that also a trivia challenge?
It was a trivia show with a tic-tac-toe conceit. And until I was on Jeopardy, the record holder for longest American game show streak was this clean-cut Navy pilot named Tom McKee, who won 40-odd tic-tac-toe games, I think, in 82 or so. I actually got to meet him when I was writing the book. So there is this sort of game show fraternity that stretches back to the dawn of television.
Well, amazing. Let's get a call from St. Joseph, Missouri. And Alan. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Hi, Ken. Ken, I recognize you. I'm glad to hear it. One trivia question I had was, who played right field for the Yankees pre-Babe Ruth,
Who did Babe Ruth replace in right field, huh?
Yes.
Wow. I think you may have me there just a little before my time. And when I say a little, I mean about 50 years.
Jim Oliva, Oz, can you help us out here?
Not a sports person at all.
Okay, maybe we'll get bailed out by another listener. Who played right field for the Yankees before Babe Ruth? Alan, you've stumped two champs here. Thanks for your call.
Yeah.
Jim, what's your sense of the best trivia questions? Where do you look for them? What are some examples of your all-time favorites?
The ones that are the favorites are ones where people will have the answer somewhere in their brain. They know it's there, but they cannot dig it out. And I mean, of course, it's not available on the Internet, but they'll just, when the question is asked, they'll suddenly go, I know that, I know that, I know that.
And that begs the question then of who is it, whether it's, in Stevens Point or on Jeopardy or just at the kitchen table at home, what's the personality profile that wins, Jim?
That wins?
Yeah, what kind of person is it who's got all this stuff so readily at hand?
Well, it's a certain brain type, that's for sure. As far as winning is concerned, with this contest in Stevens Point, anybody who plays wins.
Meaning it's just for the fun of it.
Exactly. It's a game. Why do people play Monopoly? Why do they ski? Why do they ride motorcycles? It's for the fun of it.
Does it keep your town bound together more closely all year round?
It certainly creates interesting situations. I was recently thrown out of a theater in town because I went in with my note-taking tape recorder, and there was a new manager in the theater and saw the tape recorder that I talk into.
Thought you were bootlegging Hollywood?
Yeah, and called the police, and the officer came in and tapped me on the shoulder. He said, "Jim, come on, you got to go, you got to leave." And I walked out, and we hit the door, and the door closed, and the officer turned to me, and he said, "Oh, Oz, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry."
Oh, that's great. And what, do you have the answer for, let's see, what was it, the only actress, Oscar-winning actress who played another Oscar-winning actress on screen, Oz?
Oscar-winning. Perhaps Barbara Streisand.
No, that would be Kate Blanchett playing Katharine Hepburn in The Aviator.
Okay.
Take that to Stevens Point. Jim Oliva, thanks very much for being with us from Stevens Point.
Thank you very much, Ken. I hope your new baby is very healthy.
We have a baby girl on the way. Thanks, Jim.
Hey, fantastic. That's great. Jim, thanks for being with us. I'm looking here at your list of all-time favorites. Give us the poet Hart Crane trivia bit, Ken Jennings.
Oh, this is just one of my favorite anecdotes. The famous American poet Hart Crane killed himself by jumping off a boat into the Gulf of Mexico, and no lifesaver could preserve his life. And this is ironic to me because his dad, a lot of people don't know this, was Clarence Crane, the candy billionaire who invented lifesavers. So the inventor of lifesavers, his famous son died without a lifesaver.
The shortest war in history?
Oh, that's the Anglo-Zanzibar War. It lasted about 45 minutes. Hint, Zanzibar did not win.
And who coined the word nerd, we ask the trivia master.
This is a favorite of mine just because it's a word I get to hear quite a bit. Dr. Seuss. It's from Dr. Seuss's If I Ran the Circus, the first known use of the word nerd.
Not long ago, Ken was on the Colbert Report and, of course, getting peppered with questions about his experience on Jeopardy by Mr. Colbert.
Did it change your life to suddenly be... Did people just walk up to you and say, "Hey, what's the only state with a unicameral legislature?"
Nebraska?
Exactly.
There you go. You got that one, Ken. Ken, what's your strong suit? What's your weakness? Can you reveal it?
I would say movies, probably my strongest suit. I would always go to the movie category first. I'm a huge DVD buff. As far as my trivia kryptonite, it seems like Jeopardy kept going back to country music time and again, and I am not a country fan. I guess I'm a little bit rock and roll. So that would probably be my my weak suit. That and hockey. They kept having hockey questions that I had no idea about.
You've got answers. We've got questions. Anne's calling from Potsdam, New York. Hi, Anne. You're on the air with Ken Jennings.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question for you.
Great.
What is the name of the actress who starred in the play Our American Cousin, who was acting when President Lincoln was assassinated?
Now that's got the makings of a good trivia question. You've got drama, you've got intrigue, you've got...
Right.
All right, Ken Jennings, how about it?
You know, I don't remember... I just read Sarah Vowell's book about the presidential assassinations, but I do not remember this. I do remember that she was called a sockdologizing old man trap in the second act, and that was the laugh line that Booth used to shoot the president. But I don't remember her name.
Wow. Well, you've got sub-trivia there with sockdologizing old man trap and Booth shot. Who was it, Anne?
Laura Keene.
Laura Keene. What do you know about her?
Well, to me, the most interesting thing about her is that she weaseled her way up to the box where the president was dying and ended up cradling his head on her dress. And the dress afterwards, parts of it were sold with blood on it.
The first VH1 diva, I guess.
Yes, right.
Wow, right off the stage and into a little bit of big history there. And thanks very much for your call. Ken, we want to hear your downfall on Jeopardy after all those games, 74 games, then came the 75th. We've got some tape of those last minutes on the game, but talk us into it. What was going on here? At the end of 74 games, were you ready to lose? Did you want to get out of there? That was a lot of trips to L.A.
It was getting a little bit tiring, and I was the magic was sort of gone. I was as sick of it as you can be sick of a job where you're still making $70,000 an hour, effectively. But it no longer had its original magic. But I was still playing to win, and it's just one day the breaks are going to be against you. It's amazing that I had lasted as long as I did. In Brainiac, I say that there were maybe 12 games where if one question had fallen a different way, I would have lost. So that finally stacked up against me here in Game 75.
And then came this one. Let's listen. Ken Jennings, Alex Trebek, Jeopardy, and all the rest. He was up against Nancy Zurg, a real estate agent from California, in his 75th and last show. Here's the final moment.
The category is business and industry, and here is the clue, ladies and gentlemen. Most of this firm's 70,000 seasonal white-collar employees work only 4 months a year. 30 seconds. Good luck. Nancy, you wrote down your response rather quickly, I thought. I hope it's correct. Let's take a look.
So too.
What is H&R Block? You're right. Your wager, 4,401, taking you up to 14,401. You have a $1 lead over Ken Jennings right now. And his final response was FedEx. His wager was 5,601. He winds up in second place with $87.99. And Nancy Zurg, congratulations. You are indeed a giant killer. Our new Jeopardy champion, 14,401. Ken, take a look at the audience. The audience is paying tribute to not only Nancy, but to you as well. All good things have to come to an end.
And there it ended. Nancy Zurg, the giant killer, the giant Ken Jennings, is with us. The question was, most of this firm's 70,000 seasonal white-collar employees work only 4 months a year, and you respond FedEx, something fritzed out there. What was going through your mind, Ken?
Apparently not H&R Block. The question only says, a seasonal business. So I had no idea what that season would be, and I spent the whole 30 seconds thinking of businesses that might do good holiday business. I thought it was going to be a Christmas season thing.
Right. And off it went. There goes Nancy Zurg. You write in the book, you could see her writing with her electric pencil or whatever it is, and you knew that she was pushing ahead of you there, and there was no way to somehow retrieve this one.
Yeah, that sort of helped freeze me as well, realizing immediately that she knew the answer. I could hear the little clicking and tapping of her pen, and I knew, well, that's sort of ball game.
But $2.5 million in the black, he can live with it. Let's get a call from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Don is on the air. Hi. Don. Hi.
Hi. I think people are really attracted to trivia games because they get to be right. People love to be right.
Yes.
Like if they get an argument or something,
right,
come out on top or be the one with the one who knows more, something like that.
Yeah, the thrill of being right and the other person is wrong.
Well, yeah, and not necessarily that the other person is wrong, but I know something. I'm the guy who knows something.
Yeah, Ken, what do you say about that motivation?
I think that's spot on, and I think trivia is very attractive because there is inevitably a provable right answer. You can flip over the card and see, oh, it was F Troop.
Right.
And real life does not always work like that. The questions we have to solve on a daily basis often do not have an easy back of the card answer, and that's very attractive, I think.
Mm.
Cool. Don, thanks. Yes, you get more?
One more question?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how many shows do you guys shoot in one time? Do you shoot just one show a day, or would you shoot 10 shows in one day?
Jeopardy tapes 5 shows in an afternoon, so a whole week's worth of shows. It's a very busy day. Your feet and your brain start to hurt by the end.
Cool. Thanks for the show.
You got to have stamina, Don. Thanks very much for your call. You've had your criticism of Jeopardy. There was a hubbub a couple of months ago when on your website you were going after them. Snarky, said the New York Post. You went after them, calling their questions effete and left coast, junk nobody's ever heard of. I know old folks love Alex Trebek, but nobody knows he died in that fiery truck crash a few years back and was immediately replaced with the Trebektron 4000. Biting the hand that fed you, Ken?
It was just a list of goofy. If you look at the original blog post, it was clearly just affectionate satire. It was a list of goofy suggestions that, Jeopardy could implement to update their image. But they're obviously, they're patently bad suggestions. They should have killer bees, and Alex should hold a ventriloquist's dummy on his lap. But the New York Post enterprisingly found that if you took certain specific cherry-picked quotes, you could make it look like I was hating on Jeopardy, and therefore, obviously, the worst kind of ingrate. But no, not true. I'm a huge fan of the show.
And are you still in the trivia biz? You were in computers for a long time. Have you left that behind?
I did leave my computer job, at which I was frankly pretty lousy, in order to write the book, and I just had such a great time writing Brainiac. I don't know if I'm in the trivia biz, but I think my brain will certainly always be wired this way, and I guess the curse of trivia is just finding yourself interested in virtually everything, so I hope there's no shortage of other stuff I could write about.
Wow. Let's take another call. No, it looks like we've got one just gone away there. Give us more of your favorite trivia questions, Ken. What have you got?
Let me see. I just notice stuff all the time. I was driving down the street the other day, and I passed an Olive Garden, and most people, you know, I think would think nothing of that, but I immediately saw some trivia question. I thought, oh, hey, what's the fruit in the Olive Garden logo? I thought it was interesting that it's not, in fact, an olive. It's a bunch of grapes, it turns out. And I thought, you know, that could be a great trivia question.
The singer who said, great game of golf, fellas, reportedly, as he died, last words?
Those are reputed to be Bing Crosby's last words.
And the scene from Chinatown where Evelyn Mulray comes in perspiring just right before she meets J.J. Gittes. What? Why?
She's been horseback riding. I think she says she's been bareback riding.
Let's see. The candy that invites you to taste the rainbow.
Those are Skittles.
There's just
this is very easy when you pull all the trivia from my book. Well, this is beautiful. I wish Jeopardy was so obliging.
Right. We do it all for the listeners, you know, Ken. And, you know, I found myself wondering if there are general areas of trivia where amateurs are most effective. When you're among pros, are there veins that you know are going to come up where mere mortals can't follow?
I think the H&R Block question is actually a pretty good example of that. You know, that's sort of a person on the street kind of question. You know, somebody who does use a tax preparation company might immediately see the answer to that. Whereas, you know, somebody with a PhD in pre-Columbian civilizations or whatever, you know, may still have no clue. The 75-game winner may get it wrong.
Is trivia expertise a mark of intelligence? Does it mean you're an intelligent or a person, a genius if you're really great at it, or just a particular kind of sticky mind?
It's certainly a common myth. You know, it's very common to look at these people on Jeopardy and think, oh my gosh, that guy knows all his state birds and kings of England. He must therefore be a total genius. But, you know, these guys aren't the ones out curing cancer. But I do think there's more of a connection than people often say. For a lot of these people, trivia is not a substitute for real knowledge. It's just a symptom of a busy, active brain. And I think the more things you have in your head like that, the more valid your critical thinking is likely to be.
You spend some time writing about Trivial Pursuit, which is where most people, I suppose, intersect here. 20 million copies or something of that game sold at this point. And you go back to the man you say may have been the taproot for that. The courts may say different. But you meet with him in California. Who was that? What did you find?
Very interesting story. A guy named Fred Wirth, who wrote the series of incredibly popular trivia encyclopedias in the 70s. These things were always beside my bed as a kid, you know, well thumbed through. Pretty much Fred downloading every trivia fact from his, you know, sponge-like brain in alphabetical order. And he later found out that Trivial Pursuit had stolen about a third of their original questions straight from his book. He found that he had put in a little false fact. He said that Lieutenant Columbo's first name was Philip. And when he saw that Trivial Pursuit had lifted that as well, he knew that was his smoking gun, and he took them to court for $300 million. And the courts ruled against him, saying, of course they borrowed from your book. It's an encyclopedia. They are allowed to refer to encyclopedias. And you can understand the ruling, but for poor Fred, it essentially ruined his life for a few years. Having, you know, watching these people make essentially billions of dollars from his trivia without him ever seeing a dime was frustrating.
Were you surprised as you saw that game unfold in all its glory? Were you a practice master there before you were a master on the show?
Trivial Pursuit and Jeopardy came back about the same year, early 80s. And that was sort of it was like a perfect timing for me. I was about 10 years old, you know, which is the time when kids love to start annoying their parents with the facts from the Guinness Book of World Records or whatever it is. And suddenly there was also this massive pop cultural phenomenon that like said, hey, this is valid. This nerdy thing you do is for a moment the most popular fad in America. So that, yes, that was, Trivial Pursuit was a huge part of my, you know, childhood love affair with the game.
ESPN, the magazine, called you smarmy and punchable with the personality of a hall monitor. Not everybody loves the trivia master.
I wonder if that is just some sort of lingering nerd versus jock thing. You know, it's part of some people's persona to, oh, look, there's a nerd. I can recycle all my 80s nerd movie jokes about pocket protectors and differential calculus and whatever.
You go to the geek side, and Slate Magazine says the Michael Jordan of trivia, the Seabiscuit of geekdom. Let's go to Enosburg, Vermont. Bob's calling. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hello, how do you do?
We're well, sir. What
An
do you...
An honor to talk to both of you.
Wonderful to have you. What have you got for us?
Well, I had a trivia question for Ken. Who was the first prime minister of Finland?
Whoa, put on your reindeer antlers.
This is an excellent question because it does sort of demonstrate the difference between trivia and minutiae. You know, unless this answer is something that would make, the average Joe say, oh, my gosh, that's great. I can't wait to tell my friends. It might not be as valuable as a trivia question.
Wouldn't know it if it wasn't somebody who I knew.
Was it your great-grandfather, Bob?
Yes, my great-step-grandfather. I forget how that came about.
And give us the name so we can put it away in our trivia files.
His name is Oskari Tokoi.
The Oskari Tokoi, that's worth remembering just for the name.
I was able to meet him and everything. He has a book out, which is quite good.
That's terrific. Everybody's great-granddad makes good trivia when they've got something going there. That's great.
It's more genealogy than trivia this morning. That's great.
We've got the intersection. Bob, thanks for your call. Let's go to Rayville, Louisiana. And Jimmy, hi, Jimmy, you're on the air.
How you doing, Ken?
We're good. What do you know, Jimmy?
I want to know what Sting's real name is and how did he get the nickname Sting?
The rock star Sting and the origin of that name. Ding, ding. Here we go. Ken Jennings, what do you say?
Sting's name is Gordon Sumner, and the story of how he got the name, this is really bugging me because it's like at the tip of my tongue. You know, I can sort of picture the Rolling Stone article, but I can't for the life of me remember. Oh, no, he had this yellow and black striped sweater or something, and he looked like the Honey Nut Cheerios bee or something. And so they started to call him Sting. Is that right? Is that close?
Jimmy? Have we got it, Jimmy?
That's it.
That's it. Ah, we great. Got it. Straight on. Terrific. Terrific. We've got a couple things we've got to clear up before we let you go. We asked what comedian was born Albert Einstein and had to be rescued from that name when the genius overtook it?
Albert Brooks is also Albert Einstein.
Let's see. What else do we have there? Oh, yes. He who was, born in... I'm losing it. Born in
Europe, died in Asia, buried in Africa, I think.
Yes, the great
Alexander the Great,
the great
among
conquering
other
hero. Terrific. Let's see. And those who, the authors who all married their first cousins, not only authors, authors and ruler.
Let me see. H.G. Wells, Queen Victoria, Charles Darwin. I can't remember.
And the aforementioned Albert Einstein. There we go. What do you think is going to happen with trivia in the age of the web? Does it change, Ken Jennings, over time, or is it always the same challenge for the human mind to grab onto this stuff? Does it matter that it's within such reach?
The future of trivia is sort of an interesting question. You know, maybe the availability of all facts via Google is going to make us less interested in knowing this in our head. It will have just less value to carry this around. No one will care to be the guy in the room who knows the lyrics to every TV theme because it's also easily searchable. It's also possible that as pop culture fragments into, you know, many more different channels and lots of tiny little niches, that it will be harder to ask trivia that everyone knows just because, you know, it's not a three-network country anymore. There's thousands of different tiny little pastimes and interests. So I eagerly await the future of trivia. I don't think it's over, but I'm eagerly awaiting what it'll bring.
And have you hung up your spurs, or are we going to see you back in the competitive saddle one day, Ken?
I think 75 games is a pretty good way to take care of your competitive trivia, Jones. I don't know when the Spurs will come back on.
75 games, $2.5 million. Ken Jennings, author of Brainiac. Ken, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.